Hey folks, welcome to the podcast. So let me get right to it. I think I mentioned that my dog finds me annoying. Like whenever I walk into a room, he immediately gets up and walks into the other room. Like, and I don't mean after like 5 minutes. I mean, literally I step on the carpet in that room and he's in and he looks at me with this dirty look like, ugh, this asshole again. And he walks into the other room. And then if I walk into that room, he gives me another look like, really? I just got comfortable in here. Come on, man. You're killing me. And my wife says it's the sound of my voice that annoys him. Like, do I sound like fireworks or a vacuum cleaner to you people? I don't. And then I started to think, like, the roles are reversed. Like, I'm supposed to annoy him. He's supposed to annoy me. I'm not supposed to annoy him. I'm the human. He's the dog. Dogs annoy humans. I'm afraid to go to sleep near him. I'm afraid I'm going to wake up. He's going to be driving me to the pound to get neutered. But ultimately, the dog got sick. Rusty is his name. And, you know, we had to put him down. But that was a whole ordeal. Now, I tend to confront people in consumer situations. If I think I'm getting screwed, I speak up. My wife's like, you don't always have to, you know, fight about stuff. But I think you do. Otherwise, things don't change. So with that background, it's like 3 a.m. The dog's really sick. We think it's time to put him down. He had lymphoma cancer, and it was coming on for a couple of months that he was going to have to go. And so we take him to this 24-hour vet place in Manhattan. And we said, we think that the dog has to be put down. And the woman, so vet tech goes, oh, it's $350 to put the dog down. I'm like, okay, wow, that's a lot. I think I'll just take him to the highway and let him loose. That'll be free. I said, well, we're not sure if he needs to put down. Can we have the doctor look at him? She goes, that's $170. So, like, I'm getting agitated already because this is a very personal thing. This is our dog. We love him. It's emotional. And she's just talking to me about numbers. Like, I'm negotiating to buy a flat screen at Best Buy. So I'm like, I said, there's nobody here. There's literally nobody. You're going to charge me to just look at the dog? He obviously needs to be put down. She goes, well, if you think he needs to be put down, you should put him down. I go, I'm not a vet tech. I don't have this smock on that you have with the little badge that says asshole, whatever. So I say, can he just literally look at the dog? Like, just stand in the room. His eyeballs will make contact with the dog's body and his hands or feet or penis will not touch the dog. Because I've touched my dog with my penis and it just doesn't work out. He finds it annoying. So she goes, I still have to charge $170. And I go, give me a minute. Now my wife's upset. I'm upset, but I'm getting into like consumer mode. Like, this is bullshit. I'm getting screwed because they're manipulating you. You don't have to spend $520 to kill a dog. That's just, they know they got you by the short hairs and they're going to squeeze you. There was no humanity to it. So I'm ranting like, I don't need this. I'm in the middle of the waiting room. You think I'm going to pay $520? I got a pillow at home for $13.95 from, you know, Bed Bath and Beyond. I could smother him with that. I'll be out $14 plus tax. Fuck this place. So I say, I'm not doing this. And I get the dog and we leave. So we go home. Now it's like 4 a.m. And we're gonna take him to another vet and see if we can get a better price. So yes, I'm comparison shopping executions. Okay, there, I said it. So we go home. Now my son had said goodbye to the dog. It was emotional. And he went to bed. We took the dog. And then he wakes up at 7 a.m. to go to school. And the dog's still there, alive. And he goes, what happened? What happened? And I'm like, sometimes death takes a holiday. So he had to say goodbye all over again to the dog. We take the dog to the ASPCA down the street from us. I say, how much? First of all, I walk in, the woman goes, boy, that dog looks like it's in rough shape. I'm like, well, that's pretty observant. You probably passed 0 classes in vet school. I could have told you that. And I go, how much to put the dog down? She goes, $85. I'm like, seriously, $85? I went out and I got 2 other dogs and had them killed. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's a bargain. Like, you can't pass up a bargain like that. It's like you see a jacket and it's so inexpensive, it's on sale. You buy 2 other jackets. Different colors or same color. You don't even need 3 jackets, but it's so cheap you feel like you're screwing yourself if you don't. So we put the dog down and we got a new dog, Daisy, and it's a girl. And I will tell you about her in the future. Enjoy my guest this week, Billy Gardell, great comedian, star of Mike and Molly, and he's currently in the Sun Records miniseries that's on CMT. He plays Colonel Tom Parker. Really cool conversation with Billy. We cover everything from comedy to family to, he's got a great, great story how he got the role of Mike and Molly. Just, we cover everything. It's one of the most complete interviews I've done because of him. He's great. The episode's great. Enjoy it. All right, everybody, welcome to my podcast. Thanks for joining us. Very, very special guest this week. Guy, a friend of mine, and a guy that I've been wanting to talk to about comedy. Brilliant comic. Billy Gardell, who can be seen currently on CMT in an 8-episode series, Sun Records, where he plays Colonel Tom Parker. He's touring theaters and casinos this summer, working on a new hour-long special. We hung out in New York a couple of days ago. How you doing, buddy? Welcome.
Good, Paul. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. We ended up, it was funny because I started texting you about doing the show, and then you're like, I could do this and that, and then you text me an hour later, hey, we're on the same show together in New York.
Yeah, and like two veteran comics, we ended outside standing by some garbage cans talking.
Yeah, exactly.
It's always a mark of veteran leaders.
Yeah, exactly. And you, and both of us going, boy, we can't get a cab. Jesus Christ. And we're not even black. What the fuck?
You know what? You had that New York whistle. That made me dad envious that you had that New York whistle. I've never been able to do that whistle.
My brother taught me that. You have to have huge lips like mine. But
apparently, man, you should be playing trumpet somewhere. That was unbelievable. I told my son, I go, this guy could whistle. Will, I go, they could hear him on 9 blocks away. That's a whistle.
That was it right there. There you go. I'm putting my kid through college on blowjobs that I give at Port Authority. So,
man, you got to do what you got to do. Once you're a dad, all bets are off. I'm at the point in my career where if they said, hey, do you want to be the apple in the Fruit of the Loom commercial? I'd say, well, what time you need me down there?
Yeah. Well,
if you haven't passed the I need to be an artist thing by the time you're 35,
you're right.
You're probably going to die alone eating quiche and talking to your cat.
Well, it's
that's just my opinion.
It's funny because I wanted to talk to you about that. I mean, you of all people, after Mike and Molly and the huge success of that 6 years running, you know, you're okay. You got a few coins, a few shekels, but do you ever lose that? Because when you start out as a comic, and I would imagine a musician, whatever, you're so starved for any kind of work, you can't say no to anything. Are you
right?
Are you like, now you're touring, are you like more selective, or is it still hard to say no?
Well, I think when you get a few of the house's chips, that you can play a little more conservatively. But I think you have to come to a place where you surrender to, you know, I think you spend, and again, this has been my journey. I don't know if it works for everybody. I'm sure there's two bitter comics smoking cigarettes somewhere going, fuck him, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And that's fine, too. But my philosophy at about 38 in this business was, you know, man, I got to do whatever the opportunity is. You can spend your whole career smashing your hand on a door that you want to open when three are open right next door to you.
Well, give people context. Hang on. So at this point, it's before
like
Mike and Molly.
This is
before Mike and Molly hits,
yeah,
and all that.
Mike and Molly, absolutely. And right. I think every comic wants to be, you know, hip and cool and revered and all that. And there's only so many slots for that. And if your number doesn't get called for that, your number doesn't get called for that. Right. If your number gets called to be a mainstream, middle-of-the-road comic, and that matches truly who you are, you have to kind of embrace that, man. You know, like, I'll tell you where I'm cheesy. I love game shows.
Yeah.
I hosted this game show last year, the Monopoly Millionaires Club, and we bankrupted it because it gave away too much odds guys. The odds guys did it wrong, and we messed up the insurance.
What color is an orange?
Stuff, you know what
is
I mean? I love that stuff. I really do, man, and I wouldn't mind doing another one. You know what I mean? So, you know, I think in my younger days, I would have been like, game show? I'm not doing a stupid book. Game show,
right.
You know, but I think as you grow up, you're unafraid to embrace your weirdness. I like Huey Lewis in the news too. Completely comfortable. You know what I mean?
Well, it's funny, you know, because did you find yourself? I agree with you. I'm like, did you find yourself trying to be that comic, which is edgy and blah blah blah, and then you had to embrace yourself.
I did, man. I was the angry guy when I was really young because I had come out of a. you know, I'd come out of a home with a couple of stepfathers and some other stuff I had to work through. And then, you know, I got to be about 30, 31, and I was married, and then I had a kid shortly after that, and that changed everything for me.
How so?
I'm like, I can't be walking around like, you know, Vlad the Impaler when I'm, like, you know, going home and watching Teletubbies and The Wiggles, you know? So I was like, I got to embrace where my life is now. So that kind of started to change it for me. And when I started to write about stuff that was going on in my life, you know, it just became more clear to me who I was. And then, you know, with success, you know, it's really hard to sound angry when you have a lot of success. You know what I mean? And I'm not by any means an A-list star. You know, I'm middle management. I'm a guy who did really good on a hit sitcom. But I understand that. You know what I mean? So the idea of acting like I'm all put upon and oppressed is ridiculous. You
right.
know, I'm not.
Right.
That's not what's going on in my life. So I find that writing about stuff, you know, I got a teenager now, and I've been married for 15 years, been together 17 years. That's the stuff that I talk about because that's what's going on with me.
Yeah. Some guys, when they reach that point and they start to have a family, they can't disconnect and make the adjustment and end up being shitty fathers and husbands and never present because they're still chasing this thing when you can continue to chase it, but you just have to chase it a different way. It's not
well,
like-
it can't be the priority. Here's what happened when I finally embraced my fatherhood and my being a husband and all that. I realized that my life is not in show business. Now, I'm not saying that that works for everybody, but I realized that show business is just a means for me to pay for the things I like to do in my life. And when I started to look at it like that, it not only took the pressure off of chasing this thing down and worrying about what I was going to become, but it became more of a, this is just a job to make some dough so that I can live a comfortable life with my family. And if that means, you know, I'm going to be the apple in the Fruit of the Loom commercial, then that's what that means.
Right.
I don't have any problem with that.
Right.
You know, some guys don't, and we need those guys. You know, you need the really edgy guys.
Mm.
You need them to kind of be the warning track so the rest of us have the entire field to play in. I just found that for me, that wasn't my calling.
Was when you made that adjustment to understanding it was a job and it wasn't the epicenter of your life, did you worry about sort of that you're essentially taking your foot off the gas a little bit and you won't attain your huge big dream? I mean, I think you're right. In the beginning, we all sort of dream, hey, I'd like to be a star or one of the stars in a sitcom or have a movie career or host my own talk show. And you're chasing that, and then you make this adjustment. Did you have to come to terms with not dedicating as much of your emotional and actual time to your career?
You know, man, what happened to me was it became a relief. It became a relief to make my family my focus, my number one focus, and my business my second focus.
Mm.
And then in the interim, a lot of different things happened. Kind of the perfect storm happened before I hit Mike and Molly. You know, I was actually getting ready to leave L.A., and I had a small development deal with Nickelodeon that was on the table, and, you know, I'd had a couple years where I just wasn't getting booked. I wasn't getting, you know, any kind of work stand-up-wise or acting-wise, and I just thought, maybe that's just it, you know. And because I was in a place where protecting the family was first and foremost, I was going to take a gig. I do a radio show every Tuesday morning. I call into my hometown radio show, WDVE. I get up at 5, and I do an hour and a half with those guys every Tuesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So my buddy Randy Bauman, who runs a great show back there, was like, why don't you come back here? We'll put you on the radio full-time. You work till 10 a.m. You go home and raise your family. And being on a, you know, they're like the number one station in Pittsburgh. They cover the Steelers, the Penguins, the Pirates. And to me, that would have been heaven, too. Like, I go home, I take care of my family, make a decent wage in Pittsburgh, and okay, we call it a day. And what the agreement I made was, I said, look, man, I'm going to take you up on that offer, and I was very grateful for it, and I said, but I'm going to ride out one more pilot season. And I got 6 auditions in 3 months. Now, pilot season is, you know, that time, you know this, but
yeah,
maybe some of your listeners know, but it's that 3-month period where all the new shows that are going to be put on are casting, and you hope to get on one, then you hope it gets picked up, you hope it goes to series, and you hope it runs.
Right.
I got 6 auditions in 3 months, and the last audition I got was Mike and Molly.
Wow.
And then they started calling me. They said, Chuck Lorre wants to see you. Chuck Lorre wants to see you. But I had this little tiny deal with Nickelodeon, and I was going to take that and use that money to move back to Pittsburgh because I didn't think that project was going to go, but I would have made enough dough to get my family out of here to a place where they could be raised and everything would be all right.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I passed on Mike and Molly at first. I said, no, I'm not going to go in on that.
Wait a minute. You said no to a network sitcom, Chuck Lorre? Are you out of your
mind? Actually, I didn't say yes until Chuck Lorre called me. He's the one. Here's how it went down. I'd love to go. I passed because I wanted to make him wait. That's not it. I was completely shitting my pants, terrified that if I let go of the Nickelodeon thing, because I was still going to have to go through the Mike and Molly audition process, and if I didn't get that, I would be left with nothing.
I thought you were sort of booked. It was solid.
No.
You have the part.
No. I had this little deal on the table that was going to get me home, and then the Mike and Molly audition happened, and they said casting wants to test you for the network.
Right.
And I said, tell them thank you, but no thank you, because I got this other little deal. And I was using that deal to get out of town, and I was terrified to let go of that little bit of money so that I could get my family back home, and I was afraid that if I didn't get through the Mike and Molly test, then I wouldn't have either, and I'd be stuck in the same situation.
Right. For people listening, the test is they get the cast. We think these are our people. They do a show in front of network executives, and then
you do your audition in front of them, and them and the production company, which was Warner Brothers, and there's usually like three Mikes, three Mollies, two Victorias, two Carls, and they pick the best of the best, and you have to win that spot.
Right.
So I kept saying I didn't want to go in, and it wasn't out of I'm being cool and making them wait. I was just fucking terrified that if I lost that other deal, I'd just be screwed.
Yeah.
So finally it got up the ladder to Chuck that I wasn't going to come in. And to Chuck Lorre's credit, man, he called me and spoke to me for an hour. And really, he was so fantastic. Like, he called and he said, look, man, I'm not going to make you do this show alone. I'm going to surround you with a great cast. You're not going to have to carry the water up the hill by yourself. He goes, but I'm telling you, you're the guy for this. You're the guy. And to hear that from him went so far because, I mean, he's the Norman Lear of our generation. And so I said, all right, man, I said, can I? And I was very honest with him. If I was, you know, because he said to me, he goes, why did you come in here and audition then? I go, I was hoping for like a reoccurring thing down the line.
I thought I was going to be the guy delivering pizza every episode.
Yeah, I go, if I was 22, I'd be over there washing your hubcaps right now. But I was very honest with him. I said, Chuck, you know, I said, I'm almost at the end of my rope. I'm in debt. You know, my marriage isn't going as good as I want to. I got a kid. I'm going to be straight with you, man. I got this other little deal, and I'm just afraid that if I let that go and I don't get through the audition process at Mike and Molly or the network decides they don't want me, then I'm left with nothing. And he was so cool, man. He said the really cool stuff. He goes, look, man, you have to have a little bit of faith. And he goes, and I'm pretty good at getting what I want, and I want you as this guy.
Jesus, that's like...
So I said, I go, can I please call my wife and just talk to her a little bit about this? And he said, absolutely, man, call me on Monday. And he spoke to me for like an hour, man, just really encouraging and he was a guy that changed my life.
Yeah.
And I'm still friends with him to this day and very grateful for that.
So I'll let you continue, but I think some people probably thinking, well, if Chuck Lorre, who is a god and is the showrunner, says, I want you, why did they need to do a test with you or for other people? Is it just going through the motions for the studio and the network?
I think it's the motions for CBS, you know what I mean? But I mean, when I got to Chuck, he'd been on, you know, Roseanne and Grace Under Fire and Big Bang Theory and 2 and a Half Men. So, pretty sure they were going to listen to him. But I was still a little nervous, you know. That was my own fear. Yeah. So I called my wife, man, and we weren't doing great at that time. You know, marriages go through ups and downs, and we were at a tough place, man. And I have to give my wife a lot of credit because even though we weren't doing great, after I told her the whole story, she said to me, she goes, you know what, honey? She goes, doesn't matter where we're at right now. She goes, you've been waiting on that phone call your whole life. So I have to really give my
That's
wife a lot of credit, man. So I called Chuck back on Monday. I said, okay, man, I'm yours. I'm in. Tell me what you want me to do. And he came in, and we did a couple workshops, and then all these weird, wonderful things started to fall into place. I said to him, I go, man, listen. There's a place at CBS called The Basement. I'm not even sure if they do it anymore, but it used to be the old CBS Center over on Fairfax.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went to test for a show, they walked you through the building quietly. You get into an elevator. You go down an elevator to the basement. Then there's a little theater inside there that has maybe 25 seats. And the executives sit in the dark, and then you sit in a chair like you're being fucking interrogated on Law and Order with one light on you. And you do your audition to these people. And I have been over there 10 times. One time I got over there and tested three times. The third time I went in there, I literally said to the executives, I go, look, if I don't get this one, can I get on Survivor so I can lose some weight? Nothing.
They didn't laugh at that?
Nothing. Fucking peep. You heard the joke hit the back of the wall. So I said to Chuck, I go, I got to be honest, man. I go, I have left more audition blood in the basement of CBS than anyone else I know. I go, I can't go over there. And so here's what he did. And this is when I first started to really see how respected he is. He goes like this. He goes, okay, well, I'll get him to come over to my office.
Wow.
That now we're in a different league. Now we're playing for the Yankees.
Wow, that's like going to the
mountain. So he has them all come over, and then the production company is Warner Brothers. Now, Peter Roth is the head of Warner Brothers.
Right.
Peter Roth gave me my first development deal 15, 18 years ago when I first got to town when he was at Fox. So as soon as I walked in the door, he's like, Billy, I'm so excited for you. So now I got Peter Roth and Chuck in my corner. So now I started to feel really good about it. And then they brought Melissa in. And I know this is going to sound cliche and very Hollywood-y, but I promise you this is what happened. When we read the script together, Everybody in the room knew that was it.
How did you know? How did you know that in the moment?
You could feel you could just feel the body languages all shift.
Yeah. Are they laughing?
Jeff already knew. They were not just laughing, but they were excited because they said, okay, they could feel it.
Yeah.
And then Melissa and I both read it, and we were like, holy, wow,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it was just correct. And then all these wonderful things happened, man. We ended up getting Jimmy Burrows, who directed Taxi and Cheers and Friends and Will and Grace. And, you know, Burrows usually does about 8 to 10 episodes, and then he takes off and does another show.
Mm.
He stayed with us for 2 years because he really loved us. And the education in that, I can never explain.
Well, just tell me for a second about that, because that was something I was going to ask you. What makes him so special as a director in sitcom? Because, like you said, he's at the top of the heap. And what did you learn?
And there's a couple things. Number one, great directors, and I've been very fortunate. Like, I kind of step in shit all the time because I, you know, when I got to do just recently Sun Records, I got to work with Roland Joffe, very famous English director who did The Mission and The Killing Fields.
Mm-hmm.
Great directors, they direct intention. Like, a lot of these young directors, especially in sitcoms, will go, say it like this or say it like that.
Right.
Great directors find a collaboration with you because they're secure in themselves. And Burroughs is the master of giving you the intention of what he needs from the line or the scene. And then you get to find that in the words. So it becomes this beautiful coach-player relationship.
Right.
And then the guy's pedigree, just because he knows more than anybody. Like, he would say stuff like, take a sip of coffee after you say that and it'll get a laugh. And it did.
Wow.
And you just learn to, you begin to trust that with him, that he's a maestro, man. But the thing that impresses me most about him, Paul, and the thing I love and respect most about him is he is the best of the best, arguably the best to ever do it in the sitcom world.
Mm.
And he is the kindest man I have ever worked with.
Wow.
I love a guy that's at the top of his game like that, the top of the top of the game. And still incredibly kind.
I think part of that is that level of success. You're relaxed. You're secure in yourself. You know you have a place in history. I found that Paul McCartney on my podcast.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll tell you the story sometime. But he couldn't have been a nicer guy. And I asked him, I just said, I got to ask him. I said, I like to talk to people about process, and listeners know the story, but I don't want to belabor it. But I said, would you do my podcast? He goes, yeah, sure. Just like that. and then he was accommodating. Like, I had to call him back 3 times and set up a line one of the biggest celebrities on the planet. Meanwhile, you know, you get somebody who's not at that level, and they get abusive with the power and all that other stuff.
Yeah, and I think that can happen, too, with really successful people, too. I mean, I think it has a lot to do with who you are before it happens. My dad always says, if you meet a grumpy old prick, he was a young grumpy prick. I didn't get that way overnight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it kind of enhances.
Yeah.
But it really is pleasant to see somebody playing at the top of their game and then just as kind as can be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, unlike some stand-ups, you go back to acting, you know, you weren't like completely foreign to it, not just because you were auditioning, but I think back in Pennsylvania, you're from just outside of Pittsburgh, there was something called the International Thespian Society, Troop 850.
Ah, dude, you did your research. So it was actually in Florida, though. My parents.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, you moved to Florida after your parents divorced,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, parents divorced, and we ended up in Florida with some genius that thought he was going to start a construction business. Florida's just filled with broken dreams. Anytime you see a bad headline, it always starts, Florida, man. Anyway, we're down there, and high school was rough for me, man. But
why?
We didn't fit in, man. We were these kids from Pittsburgh, and we were broke, and we moved to this place. And, you know, every school district always scoops a group of poor kids and sends them to a nice school so that that school can feel better about themselves and they can get their funding. So we were those miscasts from our area. But once I found the kids in the drama department there, man, I was home, because it was the first group of kids that I had run into in my life that weren't concerned with being a part of a clique or doing what everybody was doing or having to look cool. They were just accepting.
You're 15 or 16 at the time. So when you were younger, was there any signs of, like, being drawn to performing as a comedian?
Oh, yeah. No, I knew I wanted to be a stand-up at about 9 years old. Around 9 years old.
Would you watch them on late night? I would watch them on late night all the time on the late night shows.
I used to spend Friday nights at my grandmother's house, man, and Johnny Carson was just a religion with us.
Yeah.
And when a comic would come on, I just thought, this guy's magic.
Yeah, me too.
And when you saw those comics come out and make people laugh at that time, and it was so new, really.
Mm.
You know, it was so new. I mean, you're talking about 1980, 1979, and I mean, it was just so cool to watch a guy come out and command a room. And then, of course, I got into my dad's records when I was young. You know, we'd go back and visit in the summer in Pittsburgh. And, he'd go to work, and I'd be listening to George Carlin albums and Richard Pryor albums and Newhart albums. So my dad had a great taste in comedy.
That's
so
very cool. And did your parents...
To hear that stuff was amazing, you know?
And your parents divorced, and did your mom move to Florida because she was with a guy that... Is that what you were referring to, the construction?
Yeah, okay. That cat was going down to Florida and thought he was going to become rich building stuff on swamps or something. I don't know what the hell he was thinking.
And then you started working in Bonkers Comedy Club. You were seating people and doing...
Yeah, I started 87, right out of high school. I was sneaking into this open mic night and the Sanfilippo brothers and George Maltesos. These two Sicilians and a Greek. and I finally came clean with them. I'd been going, you know, about 7 or 8 Wednesdays, and I got up my nerve, and I pulled them back in the kitchen and said, I just really want to be a comic, and I'm underage, and I don't want to lie about it, but I really want to do this. And they were great, man. They were like, all right, yeah, we already knew that. We just wanted to see if you were going to be a liar. So
good for you.
Once they knew what I wanted to do, they made me start working for George, the Greek. And this guy, man, taught me a whole lot about just getting it done no matter what. He just had a great work ethic and kind of reminded me of my grandfather, but a young version. But he was also a Greek, so he would scream an inch from your face. Like, the shit that he did to me would put a millennial in traction.
What did he do?
Well, just the way he would fucking scream and go off and fucking talk to you, you know, and then, like, 2 seconds later, he'd go, oh, you want to go get something to eat? You know, it was like this Jekyll and Hyde. But you were so afraid of the blow-up that you just got done what you needed to get done.
Right.
You know? So, you know, he started me, and the first thing I did was, you know, it was cleaning the club, you know, the bathrooms and straightening the chairs and vacuuming.
But you're absorbing the performances, right? You're listening with one ear.
Well, that was the gift. I mean, I get to be in the club and watch all the headliners. And at that time, man, the headliners were great every week. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw the guys that were going to become huge stars, you know.
Did you see Brian Regan?
I saw Regan came through Florida all the time. Yeah. We saw Dom Irrera. We saw Bill Hicks. Oh. We saw Sam Kinison, Jerry Seinfeld, Dice. All these guys were coming through weekly. But not just the guys that were going to become huge. there were just great comedians out there. Ben Creed, Kenny Rogerson, you know, these guys that every week, Vince Champ, and yeah. Just these guys that do it every week and do it at a great level, because it was, to me, a smarter art form back then.
Yeah.
You know, it's gone a little bit bathroom now, but that's also the sign of society. But back then, man, it was like jazz, and it was to do my chores, so to speak, and then be able to sit in the back of the room with a Coca-Cola and watch these guys do this was irreplaceable.
Yeah, I worked with Kenny and I worked with Ben Creed. Like, Kenny had a joke about, like, I went hunting and boy, they get mad at you. I went hunting for turkey. Boy, they get mad at you in the frozen food section when you like just. And then another joke ends with, like, I'm driving, I'm drunk, and then so anyway. The scuba guys come to get me out of the lake, and and he was a big drinker back then. But you're right. I mean, did you find you gravitated or subconsciously ended up having an influence from a particular comic or two that came through there?
I think a lot, man. I think Ben Creed was a big influence to me. You know, I had delusions of poetry when I was 17 because mm-hmm. of all my angst, you know, my pretend angst that you think you have at that age. I mean, everybody's got their shit. But
did that pretend angst come from the broken home?
I think the divorces and, you know, growing up a fat kid with crooked teeth and glasses and mm-hmm. the delusion of thinking I was going to end up successful somewhere. and Creed snapped me out of it, man, and taught me to really... the brevity of comedy, you know, even in a long story, the brevity. Mm-hmm. And he turned me on to, my two favorite writers are Mark Twain and Hunter Thompson. Mm-hmm. And once Creed turned me on to Thompson, I kind of found the sarcasm that I loved. Mm-hmm. And then watching Ben really influenced me. And then another guy that influenced me was Tom Rhodes. I always thought Tom Rhodes was a great comedian mm-hmm. and very masterful in his words. And I think from the combination of the two is where I kind of came out, you know. And I'm a big believer that you are your influences. You know, some of these guys, the younger kids I run into now that think they're doing something new.
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, so somebody in the 50s did a bit about this 12 times already. You know, I'll tell you the interview that freed me, man. I was watching an interview with Carlos Santana. And he was talking about tuning your guitar, and he said, look, we all have the same notes to play. He goes, it's how you tune your guitar. So my E sounds different than Keith Richards' E.
Hmm.
Keith Richards' E sounds different than Eric Clapton's E.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, so it's about how you tune your guitars. And I kind of understood that on a comedy level. Like, there's only so many things a comic can talk about.
Right.
And so it's your point of view. And once it becomes personal, then you have your own sound.
Well, you know, it's funny because I wanted to talk about that. We worked together at Gotham a week or so ago, and I watched the whole set that you did, and it was brilliant because you told the story. You got, I don't know, maybe you did 20, 25 minutes, but you got
Yeah,
you got the light of 10. You blew it. You're an asshole, and you're not even a black guy. That was the thing that freaked me out. And you told a story beginning to end and talked about exactly what you just said about your life and you have a teenager. But it wasn't like, I hate being a dad or I'm a shitty dad. It was a little bit of aggravation, but then a positive spin and message that I felt, while the topic you said, you know, mainstream, family, kids, being married, you had your own spin on it that other people don't have. And I think that's art.
Well, I think I think anytime you do a bit, man, if there's an admission in there, if there's an open admission to how you feel about something, without trying to jam it down somebody's throat, I think you bring people closer to you. They either identify, or they go, "Wow, that guy really admitted that. He really meant that."
Yeah.
And I think that's where you bring your audience closer to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you did you actually do your first, I don't know if what I read is accurate, but on a bet with some guys that you did your first open mic?
I was right out of, I'd been doing the high school talent shows and trying to get it going that way. And I was working at this warehouse, the back warehouse for a place called Zayers,
mm-hmm.
which was a precursor to Target.
Oh, they had a Zayers in my hometown in Providence.
Okay, so I worked in the back warehouse shipping and receiving. And I kept telling the guys on the line I was going to be a comedian. And they're like, no, you're not. Shut up. Just load the boxes. And I'm like, no, I'm going to be a comedian. No, you're not. Shut up. The boxes. So finally they were like, all right, we're going to bet you. Otherwise, you have to shut up. And they four guys bet me $50 each that I wouldn't go do the open mic night. And being, you know, 17, I was like, I will too. You don't take that bet. And then I had to do it because my little meager paycheck wasn't going to cover it if I didn't. So I kind of owe those guys.
Wow. And what was that like? Was it like what you thought it would? Well, you were already doing it, so it wasn't...
You know, I was already steeped in watching The Tonight Show and Letterman and A&E's An Evening at the Improv and the Dangerfield's Young Comedian special, so I already kind of knew my way around it like people know music.
Right,
know?
Right.
And my first night up, man, was great. I killed for like 5 minutes. I mean, really killed. Like, mm-hmm. It surprised me. I killed. Mm-hmm. And then I was terrible right after that for about a year before I could get my feet back.
It's funny. I was talking to Lewis Black about this. I have a microcosm of that in terms of, like, you do that joke that you just came up with the first time and it crushes, and then, like, for five times after that, it sucks. It doesn't work. Why is that? Why do you think?
I don't know, man. I don't know. And that's the madness that keeps us in the laboratory.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
That was it. That first time was enough to know, okay, I'm not doing nothing else.
Wow.
And then my first goal was, you know, if I can pay the rent and do this,
Yeah.
I'm in, man.
Yeah, I hear you, yeah. And how long until you were able to pay the rent that you were sort of still doing your other job and sort of, getting better as a comic?
I probably opened mic from 17 to 19 and, you know, starting to get little local MC gigs. And then I MC'd a lot when I was 20, and then finally somebody gave me a feature spot at 21, and I went out on the road as a feature, and a lot of Florida gigs, a lot of gigs in the South that give me the shivers to think about. Then I moved up to New York because I thought it was funny, and New York handed me my ass at the perfect time.
How so? Did you go
it was just so humbling.
At the big clubs? You went up for some of the...
Well, I went up, like, I think I got on at Dangerfields, I got on at Stand Up New York. I lived in Long Island for a year out by the Huntington Comedy Club, with Richie Minervini. He put me on stage a lot, and then I knew all the Long Island comics, you know, Jeff Zabrowski and Glenn Farrington and Melvin George and all these cats.
No, Melvin used to go up, he'd have an ashtray in his thing.
I'm cool.
Yeah.
And then I came into the city, and that's where I met Ben. And I lived in the city for a year, and, you know, just the grind, you know, the grind of doing set after set after set at the end of the night and hoping you were going to make rent that week. And New York was great because what I realized was I wasn't funny everywhere yet. I was funny in Florida. But New York City gave me that thing where you got to really be funny to a lot of different kinds of people. And then once I had been beaten properly by New York City, I moved back to Florida, kind of regrouped. And then I moved to Atlanta, worked the Southeast. Then I moved to Chicago and worked the Midwest and the Northeast. And then finally, I moved out to Los Angeles.
Was that a conscious plan to move to different geographic regions? I've never heard a comic do that, or was it just sort of you?
Well, my thing was, man, I realized, too, that I'm not a city comic. I'm a road comic. And if I was going to be a road comic...
Explain the difference for people listening, what that means to you.
I think, to me, a city comic is a cat that stays in the city, very politically aware, very hip, very edgy.
Mm-hmm.
Not always edgy, but very, very, very cosmopolitan,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think a road comic is a cat that can pretty much go anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think you can learn that in both places, but I think the road gives that to you a little bit quicker.
And that suit of clothes, so to speak, felt more right for you than the city suit of clothes.
It was more right for me.
Yeah.
It was right, and it was also because the other part of it that I loved was I really wanted to travel the country. I wanted to be able to, like, back then gas was 99 cents a gallon and I had a Delta 88.
Ooh.
And it was like a land yacht, man, and a pork pie hat and a cassette deck, and I was just free, man. I was free for a good 7 years to go city to city to city to city. And I always tried to find something cool in that city that I was there in, you know, something they were known for, and it really became a, you know, America's backyard. And
yeah,
I actually got that from Tom Rhodes too. He had a great habit of wherever he was at, going and finding something interesting about that city, and then sometimes that would inspire you.
Yeah, and he literally lived out of hotels for a number of years, just traveling the world.
And he took it to a whole new level. Tom went all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, still does.
And so through that, you started to find your voice, which leads me to, Earlier you said, you know, you were getting deals when you got to L.A., and for people listening, basically a network or a studio sees you. They say, hey, we think we could do something with this guy. So they hold to give you a development deal, which means you can't do anything with another network. They throw you some money to take yourself off the field and put yourself on the sidelines. But most of the time, and through no fault of anybody's, these things, the magic
they
doesn't happen. They don't work.
They never work out.
Because Hollywood tends to sort of pigeonhole people. So what was the thing that you kept being seen as through the different deals that you got?
When I got a development deal early, they were trying to do a working class thing with me, and which is correct. And the script never matched what I do, and it just never seemed to come to fruition. And now you can look back and go, you know, you get what you're supposed to get. But the one that I seem to, for some reason, and I don't know why, man, I don't know how active a cop anybody thinks I am. but for a while they're like on Yes, Dear, as a security guard, on My Name Is Earl as a deputy sheriff, on Desperate Housewives I was an undercover cop, on a show called The Heist I was a detective, and then finally a city cop on Mike and Molly.
Did that reel of cops or security guards, was that a big factor in getting the Mike and Molly audition?
No, it wasn't. What they were looking for was a big guy that could handle the ball busts of being a big guy, but also had a big Gleason heart underneath it.
Wow.
And the thing that won me that role was there's a scene in the pilot where I talk to her kids at the school.
Mm.
And that was I talk about my father, and that's what they were looking for, because I learned later they'd seen some other big guys that could handle the funny parts.
Mm.
But it was that, it was basically, you know, Burroughs used to call them our baby, you're the greatest moments. Mm. You know, that's why you really loved Gleason. That's why you let him get away with all his nonsense, because it was that last moment at the end of the sitcom when he looked at her and had to apologize,
and
be humble, and tell her how much he loved her. And that's what they were looking for.
Oh, that was also the time when you could threaten your wife with physical abuse and everybody thought it was funny.
No, there's a whole thing now. But I think how we knew how he was, I think we got the message that he would have never harmed her. You know what I mean?
I think you knew that he... And you also understood... my son's been watching it, and he loves it, you know, and you also understood that his intentions were good, and it was driven by his circumstances of just wanting to have a better life for himself and some and his wife. And so even though they were sort of, you know, badly...
Abrasive.
Exactly, and whatever. he was able to do that sort of... which is a really hard thing to do, is still be a sympathetic, empathetic character while being that abrasive and out of his mind at times, which is not easy to do in the writing. And then when you also think that he basically was the showrunner star, like he was directed, like he was like Bill Russell, the player coach for the Celtics, right?
Yeah, he was.
It was crazy. And then you wanted to take a break from comedy after Mike and Molly, so you did this Colonel Tom Parker Sun Records show, and which focuses on Elvis's manager Tom Parker in the day. And I read that you said, my dad was a huge Elvis fan and he wanted to go to Graceland. There was always Elvis music in our house. When Elvis died, he took 3 days off from work. Did he really?
He called in. He walked into my bedroom. I think I was about 10. And he goes, the king is dead. And he went to his bedroom for 3 days. Broke his heart.
Wow.
And that was where all the parents wanted to do a bucket list. You know, me and my wife wanted to take everybody on a bucket list. Mm-hmm. My mom wanted to go to Vegas. Her dad wanted to go to Hawaii. Her mom wanted to go to Hawaii. My dad wanted to go to Graceland. That was his bucket list. He really wanted to see where the king was from.
Oh, so, that's great.
To play that Colonel Parker character was great. And then, you know, that show was about the beginning of Sun Records, which is Sun Studios, which, you know, that's where rock and roll was born down there. It was a, you know, combination of the blues, hillbilly music, and, you know, church music all being mixed together in these sounds, and Sam Phillips had the vision to do that, and it was about that place where they were migrating to that was creating this new sound, you know.
Right.
And you had Jackie Branston and Ike Turner and B.B. King and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis, and in a time where civil rights was, you know, at a fever pitch, here's a group of guys and girls in a record studio that don't care what you look like or what color you are, it's what kind of sound you could make.
Right.
So it became a really cool thing. And Colonel Parker was fun to play because he was just this deviant that got wind of this and wanted to get his hooks into some musicians so he could make some money. And that was the other reason I loved playing that character, was because Mike on Mike and Molly did everything right, always a sweetheart.
Right.
And so to play a guy that just would lie when the truth works, was that was just fun.
Yeah.
It was fun to go the other way.
Well, you said I had to play him with a twinkle in his eye, but also get across that he was cold and calculating. How do you walk that line as an actor?
Well, I think you have to be, at any kind, look, he couldn't have gotten away with what he got away with if he wasn't charming. That's what the CEO
right, he was running a carnival scam at one point.
He was lighting a fire under a stage and pretending ducks danced for him. I mean, the guy was out of his mind, you know? But what was great was, man, he believed in the art of the sale. I think Colonel Parker liked the sale. He liked to know he got you more than the rewards that it bring.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned was, I talked to a lot of people that knew him, and nobody had the same description. So he was this guy that was...
chameleon.
He was whatever you needed him to be to get his deal done, and that's where the fun of getting the confidence of the other person came in.
And how much of that was demanded in the role that you played in the time of his life? Did you find that you had to sort of generate that ability to sort of be different things to different people in the role?
Yeah, absolutely, on the set. And again, I'm working with a great director, Roland Joffe. You know, he was really wonderful in every scene. We would go over what the colonel was trying to accomplish and what it would take for him to do that, and he was fearless to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun to do every time we worked.
Yeah, and was there anything, was it difficult to go, I mean, again, getting back to Hollywood and pigeonholing, comedian, comedic actor, great at that, don't see you as a dramatic actor. Was that a big uphill battle to get that role?
You know, we had to really, I told my agents, I go, I don't want to go right, because I got an offer for a sitcom that was absolutely horrid right after Mike and Molly.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, I can't do that. I'll have the stink of death on me if I do that.
I bet your agents were pushing you to take it, too.
Of course they were. Yeah. It's a big paycheck, but agents don't care. You know, you get another big paycheck, your career's over, they swim on to the next fish. So you have to have some,
right.
you have to have some sense when you're doing it. And I just said, look, guys, I want to do something completely different. Let's look. And one of the younger kids at my agency, Logan Eisenberg, brought me that CMT script. And I go, this is something. Because my thing is, look, I've done well, so now we're playing with the house money. Now we can afford to be a little more selective. So let's just take a swing and see what happens. Because I've always loved John Goodman's career. That's the career. Like, if you set a template for what you want to do, that's the kind of acting career I would love to have. And so this seemed to me like something he would have done. And so we started to get into negotiations to try to get that part. And that very thing you were talking about happened. A CMT's like, nah, he's a sitcom guy. We don't really see him as that. So I said, look, I'll go in and audition, which my agents were like, no, you're at the point where it should be offer only. I'm like, no, we're not going to sell that. I said, they're already saying it. So I go, I'm not afraid to go try in the room, so let me do it. So my wife and I drove over to Van Nuys, and I got a cheap suit and a big white cowboy hat and a bolo tie and a cigar, and I went in there fully in costume and did that audition for them, and I had it before I left the building.
And you knew, I mean, you just knew in the room. Again, it was like the Mike and Molly test.
I knew that I got them. I didn't know I'd get it that quick. They literally stopped me before I got to the elevator. But what I knew was, I knew that part was right. You know, you're not going to get a part that's not right for you, no matter how hard you try or rehearse or, you know.
Well, that was what you were referring to earlier when you were testing or getting cast in like one bad sitcom after another, and it wasn't right for you. And you said the right thing eventually comes along, or it doesn't.
It does if you can hang in there. You know?
Right, right. And do you think that if Mike and Molly had not come along, you'd be happy with a life of being a great stand-up headliner around the country?
Yeah, I think if Mike and Molly had not come along, actually where I would have headed was back to WDVE in Pittsburgh.
Mm.
and I would have done morning radio with those guys and raised my family, and I would have been completely at peace with that because, I, like I said, at that point in my career, I was more about, all right, you know what, I got to take care of my family, and if this happens, this happens. Yeah. I got to be smart on how to take care of my family.
Yeah.
You know, and that's that. That surrender kind of opened up everything.
How is it as a dad now, coming from a broken home? Like for me, I have a kid, and I tell him I love him all the time because I didn't hear that a lot. Not because my parents didn't. It was just not, you know, it's kind of...
No, they didn't know how, man. They had a different set of rules. And I used to say to my dad, I love you. He'd go, all right.
Who are you again? Well, all right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, all right. Okay, that's good, Bill. Come on. You gotta go. But that's what they knew. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do tell my son I love him every day. I make a point to tell him I love him every day. And I think it makes a huge impact. And I also talk with him. And, you know, we don't have any shame in our house. You get to talk about whatever you want to talk about, man. And that's, to me, that's huge.
Did you have a strong male role model in one of your stepdads, or was it kind of fixed?
I hated both of those guys. I love my dad to death, man. Yeah. I just, you know, when you're separated for that many years, it's tough.
Yeah.
And we got to be really close again when I was about 23, and we talk probably every day or every other day now.
Oh, that's great.
But I had a couple, like I said, George the Greek was a big role model, and then, of course, my manager, Chris DePetta, man, when I met
him. He's a great guy.
You know, I've been with him 30 years on a handshake.
Yeah, he's like he's a guy.
That doesn't happen anymore.
No, you know? He's one of the few reps managers where you talk to him and you hang up the phone and you go, exactly what you talked about will happen. Like a lot of, and you don't have to check to see if you still have your wallet. He's a really stand up and a nice guy.
He's been more of a father figure than a manager to me. That's how much I love him. He's also my son's godfather. And, you know, we've been down the road together, man, thick and thin. He's always been there, never turned his back on me once, always believed in me. And, you know, man, the guy, you know, he helped me get braces on my teeth when I was 22. I mean, he's been with me my whole ride.
That's great. That's great. And that's great that you're loyal to him. Some guys sort of, you know, leave for bigger whatever. We were talking about hanging outside of Gotham, like sort of stand up now and sort of versus kind of when you were doing it early on and we were starting, like, and the whole PC thing, like, where, let people know, like, where your head is on that, because it's definitely changed, but I think for you, because you're a big star, you can kind of do what you want to do and people come to you, but how do you perceive it now versus then?
You mean in what way, performance-wise, or trying to get started?
No, just in terms of there are generations of comics now and kind of what they're doing.
I think that it's somebody took the, you know, I don't think anybody should be censored as they're trying to find themselves. I think there's a common sense that has to come with your humor.
Right.
Otherwise, you're just a guy screaming.
Right, right.
And, but I think to me, if I have one critique of it, my critique is, look, I'm no genius, but my bits are thought out. My thoughts are thought out. My jokes are thought out. It seems to me that there were guys in the back of the room when I started that if you started talking about taking a shit for 10 minutes, they would come up to you, and not in an arrogant way, they would just come up and go, hey, man, you know what? You got to do better than that.
Yeah.
You got to go a step further than that. Your job is not just to make the audience uncomfortable. Your job is to make them laugh.
Right.
That's the generation of guys I came up with. And to me, what I see now is two things. I don't care either way, man. Like I said, everybody's got their own deal. But the two things that I see is, one, there's too much, I'm trying to make you awkward but not make you laugh.
Right.
And there's too much, I'm so much smarter than you.
Yeah.
I can't stand a comic that's so much smarter than the room.
Right, and
my buddy in Texas calls him Precious Comic. He's precious. He's just precious, isn't he? He's so smart. He's precious. That just annoys the shit out of me. That's all.
And I think that's based in insecurity.
It's all insecurity.
Because of the clicks. People like clicks. So,
fuck a click. Listen, the clicks are for guys that ain't working on their career.
Right.
That's what clicks are.
Right, right.
Because you can have respect for a lot of great comics. You can get along with the great comics. But at the end of the day, man, what anybody else gets has nothing to do with you.
Right.
And you have to understand, if you spend all your time going, well, fuck that guy, why'd he get this, you will not succeed.
Right.
That's one of the traps.
Right, right, right.
One of the traps. You have to just work on what you do. There's a lot of my peers out there that I really respect, that I love to watch as a fan. Mm. I love to watch Nick Griffin. I love to watch Bill Burr. Mm. I love to watch I love watching Bert Kreischer because I just never know what the fuck is going to happen.
Right.
I admire and I like all of those guys, and I wish them nothing but well. I respect all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I work on my shit when I go home. I don't worry about what anybody else gets. And I've been lucky enough to know that for many, many years.
Did you? I was going to ask you, before you had the success and you were straight up really great stand-up yourself, were you running races with other people at all?
I think the first 5-6 years of my career I was, because that's what I heard most other guys talking about.
Yeah.
And then I had a couple comics who were starting to get successful say, it doesn't matter. All that is bullshit. Just work on what you do.
Yeah.
And then Creed told me, he said, look, man, if somebody gets something, be happy for them.
Yeah, that's a great that's
it has nothing to do with you.
And you know the that's
yeah, he put it this way. Wait, I want to touch on it because that was important advice. He said, man, you know how hard you worked? You know how much you suffered? That guy probably did too. So if he gets something, just be happy for him, man.
Yeah.
Just be happy for him.
That's a
because
great.
And you don't need to walk around fucking, and why's that fucking, and fuck this, and that sucks, and blah, blah. Nothing's funny about that guy. If you become that guy, nothing's funny. You're just like, then you become that guy like, oh, is that fucking guy coming here? Okay.
I had that with somebody. I don't want to mention his name, but we shared a manager at one point, and his relationship blew up in a really bad way. And every time I saw him, he would just rant about this guy to me and why are you still with him. And then I finally had to say to him, hey, man, you had the world by the balls. You had sitcom deals and whatever, and you broke early and whatever. And you still can break again. Stop! You're becoming a different person, and you're gonna find people aren't gonna want to be around you. You got to just
And that's the other thing. Like you can't go into. You have to take everybody on your personal relationship with them, because especially in this business, you know, you go, I'm with so-and-so. I fucking hate that guy. It didn't work. Okay, man. Well, that was your experience. My experience has not been that.
Right.
And
right,
I may have that reversed.
Right.
I may hate one of the guys you worked with, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
Your experience, your path is yours, mine is mine.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And I think getting sucked into that is, you know, you lose a lot of time doing
it. Yeah. One last thing. And this gets back to when things really started to break for you in a big way and Mike and Molly came around. You were at a point, you know, there's some people that believe things happen for a reason. And when you settle in and don't worry about things, the things you want come to you. The universe kind of hears you. Do you think some of that happened because you were at a point where you were about to let that Nickelodeon deal play out and then move and step away from stand up in a significant way? And then all of this starts to happen. Do you think there's any connection there?
I think there's a real truth, and when you surrender to what you're supposed to become, you become it. And what I mean by that is, like, when you finally stop worrying about what you would desperately want and look at what is available, then that's where you end up going.
But you were surrendering. But you were
kind of get out of your own way,
right? You but you were surrendering to being a morning radio host, which is great. And so, and that's not what you got. You got the thing that you had been wanting your whole life,
right? But by surrendering and going, I'm going to do whatever it takes to take care of my family.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to see and seize that other opportunity. And I don't think I'm some special case. There's a lot of guys that are funnier than me and more talented than me. You have to have some luck too, man.
Well, I was going to say, is it that? Like, why did that opportunity come to you at that very moment? That's what I'm fascinated by.
Because I think, and I don't know for sure, but I think that sometimes when we're obsessed with what everybody else is doing, we can't see the opportunity when it presents itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
You dig? So if you get out of your way, and you just start worrying about caring about what's important, I think the opportunity that's available opens up. And it's not always great, it's not always the best thing in the world, but it is the thing that will give you peace.
Right, and that was the radio gig for you.
That was it, man. I would have been just fine with that.
But then you got something bigger that would give you even more peace, and it was maybe because you had sort of let the universe sort of decide for you?
I think it was because I let it go, yeah, man. I let it go, and I just said, you know what, man, whatever, and, you know, I'm not a big church guy, but I do believe in a God. I believe in a loving God, and I think when there's a surrender, any kind of spiritual surrender in your life where you say, you know what, man, whatever the fuck you want me to do, let me just take care of these other four eyeballs that are in my house. And suddenly, you know, you can't always get what you want, But sometimes you get what you need.
Yeah, well,
it's the Stones, bro.
It couldn't happen to
Mick and Keith. Were trying to tell us this 50 years ago.
Well, I was too stoned when I was listening to and drunk.
No, me too. I was like, what?
Is that God. well, it couldn't happen to a better guy or a better comic. So, everybody, check out CMT because you're really great in this. You're really great.
Thanks, Bob. Durant. Appreciate you, man.
Yeah, 8-episode series on CMT, cmt.com, and go to your website, I guess, Touring Theaters,
yeah,
Casinos.
Yeah, BillyGardell.com. That's got my tour dates up out there, and I'll try not to disappoint you if you come see me.
No, it's going to be great. The 20 minutes I saw was killer. I will see you when I come to L.A. I'll give you a call. We got to get together and have a beer.
Yeah, man, please do, and then we'll search for a cab in New York City.
And I'll teach you how to whistle.
All right, brother.
Thanks for being on.
Man.
All right, talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
All right, that was Billy Gardell. Thank you so much for checking out this week's podcast. If you have a dog, definitely shop to put him down. You can get cheaper prices. Maybe there's a Groupon. I don't know. And thanks for checking out the podcast. Keep tuning in and tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Our numbers keep growing. And thank you so much. See you guys next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.